case, which is Gary Back versus Joanne Barnhart. Mr. Snoffer?
May it please the court. The ALJ in this case denied benefits at step two of the well-known five-step sequential analysis. Step two is a low hurdle, not a high hurdle. The test for step two is whether a claimant has a more than minimal impairment of the ability to perform basic work activities. We believe that the ALJ made several harmful errors in law and fact when determining that the claimant did not have a step two severe impairment. In more than a dozen in about a dozen decisions of this court, this court held that an ALJ should not play doctor. That is, an ALJ should not make medical judgments beyond his or her ken. In this case, the ALJ played doctor with respect to muscle atrophy. The ALJ made a knowledge claim. The ALJ claimed that if Mr. Back had a severe impairment of use of his upper extremities, then he would have muscle atrophy. The ALJ did not cite any medical opinion or any medical authority for this proposition. The commissioner tries to excuse the ALJ's finding by saying an ALJ is required to discuss objective evidence. That is true, but just because an ALJ must consider objective evidence does not somehow imbue the ALJ with medical knowledge or expertise about particular evidence.
But why do we have to look at that finding instead of the be-all and the end-all? It seems that the ALJ did note that the doctor had said that there was no muscle atrophy, and as a piece of potentially corroborating evidence, it is there. It might still be possible to have an impairment even if you have no atrophy, but I think it was in a broader factual context that the ALJ took note of that.
I would disagree. I think that at page 15 and 18 of the judge's decision, the judge is actually saying that if Mr. Back had a more than minimal impairment, then he actually would have, he would reasonably find this muscle atrophy. And he was using this to reject, for example, the opinions of the non-examining state aging physicians who found that Mr. Back was limited to light work. So yes, in some cases, an ALJ considers muscle atrophy and other evidence in the broader case. But in this particular case, the ALJ claimed that he knew something. The doctors did not know that if Mr. Back had this step two severe impairment, then he would have this muscle atrophy. If the ALJ was right, he was very right, but the commissioner was unable to identify any medical opinion or medical authority corroborating the ALJ's assertion that Mr. Back would reasonably expected to have this muscle atrophy if he even had a more than minimal impairment of the ability to use his upper extremities. In Dixon, this court considered whether or not an ALJ played doctor. In Dixon, the court found that the ALJ did not play doctor, but instead discussed the evidence. The commissioner wants to read this court's decision in Dixon very narrowly, that whenever an ALJ discusses evidence, the ALJ does not play doctor. Discussing the evidence is a necessary but not sufficient condition for affirmance of an ALJ decision. The ALJ must also provide a rational or reasoned explanation of weighing of the evidence. In Dixon, the court noted that the ALJ discussed thoroughly the evidence, and by that I think that the court was invoking its general rule that an ALJ must provide a reasoned and rational basis for his or her findings, and he didn't in this particular case. There are two general types of play doctor cases in this court. In one type of case, there is the ALJ's play doctor and there is a related articulation error. In other cases, the ALJ plays doctor and there is no related articulation error. In at least five cases in this court, not dealt with in Dixon, where the court found that the ALJ played doctor without a related articulation error. And those are Green in 2000, Wilder in 95, Heron in 94, Schmidt in 1990, and Rusi in 1985, cited in our reply brief.
But, you know, it seems to me that the ALJ is in a difficult position because on the one hand, for these step two inquiries, the ALJ has an obligation to find medically determinable evidence on either the physical or the mental side that supports the claim of a disability. And on the other hand, the ALJ is forbidden, as you keep saying, from playing doctor. The ALJ has to discuss either what medical evidence is in the record or what medical evidence isn't in the record. And, you know, I'm looking at this section. It's actually page 3, page 9 of the short appendix, and then there's some other 15 stamped on it, so I'm not sure what page we want to call this. But he's talking about the evidence that's in the record and talking about the claimant's burden of proof, which does, for step 2, fact lie on the claimant. And he's saying, I can't find medically determinable evidence that this disability exists. Why isn't that quite what you're supposed to do?
The ALJ there made harmful errors of fact and law. The ALJ thought, for example, that range of motion findings were subjective and they would not provide the objective medical evidence necessary to find a medically determinable impairment.
But there's a subjective component which some of the doctor's reports in this case, you know, if I tell you I can't move my hand any further than this, maybe I'm not moving any further than that now, but if I really can move it over here, I mean, sometimes people hold back. Sometimes doctors need to do alternative tests to make sure the patient is responding appropriately.
Yes, and the reason the agency considers range of motion testing objective is because the doctor can make precisely those observations. The doctor will say if the range of motion testing is not objective, that there wasn't patient cooperation, for example. The commissioner in this case has not argued that the ALJ did not make a mistake regarding whether or not range of motion testing was objective or not. The commissioner has only questioned its relative importance. So yes, in many clinical situations, patient cooperation is necessary and important, but the clinician includes that information in the report. And you can see that, for example, typically in pulmonary function testing, where, you know, whether or not the patient's performing has good effort. Also in grip strength testing, also where a physician will note whether or not the patient is giving, in the clinician's view, full effect. The two non-examining state agency doctors in this case found that Mr. Back was limited to light work. That is very much more than a more than minimal step 2 impairment. In other words, compared to what the ALJ believed, the doctors were finding that Mr. Back was much, much more limited in his ability to use his arms for reaching and lifting. If I may take the rest of my time in rebuttal, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Skidmore?
Maybe you could start, Mr. Skidmore, with that light work point, because it did seem to me that if usually we hear about light work at step 5, actually, when somebody's gone through all the other steps and a vocational expert is trying to figure out what else is left in the national economy that the person can do, we find out there are 10,000 light work jobs. That does seem to rest on the premise that, if you will, heavier work isn't possible for this person, that he may have a disability.
Yes, Your Honor, that the state agency doctors opined that Mr. Back was limited to light work. The ALJ addressed those reports, and he explicitly rejected them because he said the medical evidence in the record didn't support them. Specifically, he said Dr. Beardsley's notes and statements regarding the claimant's impairments do not set forth significant abnormalities of a musculoskeletal nature. So if you look at what Dr. Beardsley said, Dr. Beardsley in November of 1998, right after Mr. Back was involved in an auto accident, he noted that he complained of shoulder and neck pain. Shoulder x-rays were normal. Neck x-rays showed some degenerative disc disease. Dr. Beardsley also reported at that time that Mr. Back's cervical range of motion was normal. His lumbar range of motion was normal. There were no neurological abnormalities, no sensory deficits, no reflex deficits, no muscle weakness, no atrophy, no loss of grip strength, no abnormalities with respect to fine motor movements, no walking or ambulation problems, no loss of major function of the arms or legs. The only abnormal clinical finding was the range of motion deficit that was identified in Dr. Beardsley's November 1998 report. A finding which, by the way, was not repeated in a report dated a few months later.
Yeah.
So basically, what the claimant's argument comes down to is that the ALJ was compelled to find that he had a severe impairment based solely on one range of motion finding and one report. If you take the broad view of the case, as you suggested, that the ALJ is required to take the broad view of the case, and you look at Mr. Back's complaints and symptoms over the course of the relevant time period, if you look at the objective medical evidence at Mr. Back's treatment history and work history, I think it's readily apparent that the ALJ's decision was reasonable and that Mr. Back's theory of the case is untenable. Mr. Back alleged that he became disabled in 1997, not because of a medical problem, but because he was laid off from his job. There was a motor vehicle accident in 1994, and there were 1995 x-rays that showed some mild arthritic changes. But during the relevant time period, from May of 97, the alleged onset date, to October of 1998, there are no references at all in the record to a significant shoulder impairment, a mental impairment, or a hearing impairment, all of the impairments which Mr. Back claims are disabling. During this period, as Mr. Back acknowledged, he saw his doctor, Dr. Beardsley, for blood pressure checks and acid reflux and other epigastric problems, not for the impairments that he claims are disabling. Then we come to October 1998 and the auto accident, normal shoulder x-rays, and all of the findings from Dr. Beardsley that were all normal except for the one range of motion finding. After the March 99 report from Dr. Beardsley, there's no additional reference to any shoulder impairments or any neck impairments or any hearing deficits. So what we have is that we have a record of an alleged onset date of 97, of May of 97, and nothing in the record at all about these physical impairments for 18 months. Two reports from Dr. Beardsley in November 98 and March 99, and nothing in the record after that. So the question is, was it reasonable for the ALJ to find that Mr. Back's impairments did not significantly limit his ability to perform work-related activities? I think on this record, when you take a broad view of the record, it's clear that that was a reasonable decision. I think it's significant at the administrative hearing in September 1999, plaintiff's own attorney conceded in his opening statement that Mr. Back's physical impairments were nominal. The ALJ ultimately agreed with this assessment.
Which, does that mean his principal theory was that of depression?
That's what he suggested at the hearing, that it was this problem with bereavement from the death of his wife. That if you look at the mental impairment evidence, there was a record of mental health treatment and counseling in 91 and 92 after Mr. Back's wife died. He had difficulty adjusting to the loss of his wife, but there's no additional mental health counseling or mental health treatment notes after 1992. He was sent for the consultative psychological exam in December 1998 at the agency's behest. Dr. Barrow found that he had some concentration deficits. Dr. Barrow didn't even diagnose a significant mental impairment. He noted that there was some evidence of this remote bereavement. At the same time, he noted that there were some concentration deficits, but he also noted that Mr. Back engaged in hobbies such as short story writing and building railroad models, you know, activities which required significant concentration. Dr. Barrow also noted that, you know, after May of 97, when Mr. Back claimed he became disabled, he worked at two part-time jobs that required some concentration. So on the basis of Dr. Barrow's report, as well as Mr. Back's reported activities, the state agency psychological consultant concluded that Mr. Back did not have a severe mental impairment. The ALJ reasonably relied on this evidence to find that Mr. Back didn't have a severe mental impairment. With respect to the playing doctor argument, which is the centerpiece of Mr. Back's claim, the ALJ wasn't playing doctor, as Judge Wood have suggested. The ALJ was weighing the evidence. He has to weigh the evidence. He has to look at the objective medical findings. The specific argument that the counsel has made here and in its brief is that the ALJ made an improper lay medical judgment when finding that Back did not have a step 2 severe impairment due to the absence of muscle atrophy. That's not what the ALJ did. The ALJ considered far more than the absence of muscle atrophy. He considered the x-rays, the shoulder x-rays that were normal. He considered the fact that Dr. Beardsley found no neurological abnormalities. And the ALJ also considered Mr. Back's activities. As I suggested, he worked part-time at two different jobs after his alleged onset date. He performed extensive household chores by his own admission. He was able to wash dishes, do laundry, shop, did all the cooking and cleaning for him and his 21-year-old son. He kept track of household bills and expenses. He engaged in the hobbies such as building railroad models and writing short stories and novels. He socialized with his son and mother and occasionally went on dates. This was weighing the evidence. This wasn't playing doctor. The cases to which counsel has referred today are all distinguishable. Most of the playing doctors are cases where an ALJ rejected a treating physician opinion that the claimant was disabled without citing any other medical authority. There's no treating doctor here who's saying that Mr. Back is disabled. There's no treating doctor saying that he has significant functional limitations. All of those cases are distinguishable. In sum, I would just like to reemphasize that this case involves an alleged onset date of May of 97. There are no references in the relevant medical records to shoulder or neck impairments before October 1998, and no references to shoulder or neck impairments after March of 1999. We have no evidence documenting any hearing loss, which is another impairment that he alleges he is limited by. We have some limited treatment for a mental impairment, but that treatment predated Back's alleged onset date by several years. The question before this court is whether it was reasonable for the ALJ to decide on the basis of this record that Mr. Back did not have a severe medical impairment. I think the answer to that question is clear. The ALJ's Step 2 finding was perfectly reasonable on this record. I thank you.
Mr. Schnuffer, you have anything more?
I just wanted to correct the record, if I could, a couple times. Commissioner's counsel says that the ALJ explicitly rejected the non-examiner's position, opinion. Take a look at transcript page 18, footnote 2, is where the ALJ actually discusses the non-examiners, and the commissioner's offered no argument trying to explain how that can be reconciled with a reasoned evaluation of the evidence. The ALJ disagreed with the state agency doctors about the meaning of light work and of severe impairment. The commissioner claims that range of motion finding is the only objective finding. That's not true. There was a cervical spine x-ray showing moderate abnormalities. The commissioner argues that psychologist Dr. Barrow, found the claimant did not have a severe mental impairment. Dr. Barrow did not say that. In fact, Dr. Barrow found on clinical examination moderate to significant limitations in Back's ability to concentrate. In this particular case, Back showed enough that he would have a Step 2 severe impairment, so the ALJ should have proceeded to Step 3. If the ALJ had appreciated, for example, that range of motion testing was objective instead of subjective, as he thought, and if he had properly evaluated the opinions of the two non-examining physicians, he would have realized that Back had a severe severe impairment and proceeded to Step 3. In addition, the commissioner argues there was no evidence after 98 of any impairment whatsoever. This cannot be reconciled with Dr. Barrow's psychological examination finding moderate significant limitations, and also with neuropsychologist Dr. Rumpel's examination in November 1999. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Case will be taken under advisement.